What's going on, everybody? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. It is me. I'm still here. I'm actually in the same exact parking spot I was last night when I was talking to Phil. I've only driven about 30 miles today. I drove about 15 miles down the road to pick up a power screener. I got there at 8:30 this morning. They didn't have it ready until about 5 o'clock at night. So then I loaded it up and got back here and had dinner. And now I'm here with Kyle from the In Liberty and Health Show. How are you doing tonight, Kyle?
Good, man. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. You know, 30 miles, that's a long day for me. So I'm, you know, trying to rest up a little bit, but doing well.
Nice. Good. Good.
Yeah. So why don't we just start off with your show? What's why In Liberty and Health? Why'd you name it that? And what's the focus of it?
Well, I noticed that a lot of libertarians were virgins. So I noticed a big disconnect in the liberty world. You know, people would have platitudes of liberty stuff, but I mean, there was a lot of people that are just out of shape. And also libertarians just generally aren't that interesting kind of people, you know? So I've been a libertarian for probably about 10 years. And I've always exercised consistently all throughout my life. I never played sports or anything, but I just always figured I saw how my family kind of ended up being in pretty rough shape towards the end of their life. I'm like, well, I never really want to do that. So I found exercise and kind of focusing on my health to be very, very important. And I found that, like I said, in the libertarian world, there just weren't a lot of interesting, fit people. And I decided I should probably start a show to kind of make people feel like it's okay to be jacked and be a libertarian.
What about like Archie Flowers, though? I mean,
well, I mean, you know, everybody kind of has their strengths and weaknesses, right? So, some more than others.
Yeah. So that's the focus of the show, too, is to try to get people to exercise or take care of themselves or.
Yeah, to spread the message of liberty and health, essentially, where, you know, I talk to libertarians, I talk to people who are more in the health and wellness space. I got one of my favorite doctors coming on here in a few weeks, Dr. Ted Naiman. He wrote the book called The PE Diet, where it basically focuses on a, you know, protein to energy model of diet, where you got to figure out how much protein you eat in a day versus like the energy, which would be like your fats and carbs. And I generally don't talk politics with those people unless it kind of has a crossover. I had Dr. Phil Ovadia, who wrote the book, Stay Off My Operating Table. And we talked all about, you know, saturated fat, cholesterol, metabolic health. And then we also kind of tapped a little bit of COVID stuff, too. But, you know, I think it's very important, especially after these last 2 years, that people recognize the importance of metabolic health, especially when it comes to COVID, because it's clear as day that people who aren't in good metabolic health have a much, much rougher time with COVID. And the media really hasn't told people that, but it's obviously true. And if you look up any data on it, it's just screams at you that that's the case. So, I mean, I had COVID last year. I'm 27 now. But it was like a walk in the park for me. I had a stomach bug in January, and I would, you know, much rather have COVID six times over than ever have that stomach bug again. I mean, I felt like crap for a couple of days and then lost my taste and smell for a week and then came right back. Good to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the health part with a lot of my fellow truck drivers can be quite, you know, quite a hurdle because – it's really easy to get into eating nothing but fried food or pizza or fatty shit that you buy at the truck stop. You can eat healthily. I mean, I do. I have to because, you know, I'm not moving all that much. I'm sitting most of the day. So to, you know, keep my weight down and everything, I've got to be smart about what I eat. But, you know, it's it is a problem that seems to just keep getting worse. Like I remember 20 years ago. Everyone was fat, but it doesn't seem like that's really changing at all. Like it seems like if anything, especially over the last year and a half with COVID, when you'd actually want people to be healthier, people were staying home and they were watching movies more and they were eating shitty food more because they weren't going out to the grocery store and getting stuff. So yeah, I mean, health has just been a problem for everybody, but especially people in my line of work, that's, you know, that's a big thing they have an issue with. especially the weight gaining part.
Oh yeah. Well, when I've worked at a couple different dealerships here in Pennsylvania and in Ohio. And, you know, I mean, all of these people are in absolute terrible shape, and your body just from working on cars just gets destroyed, especially if you don't take care of yourself. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to. Oh, I need knee surgeries, back surgeries, you know, my wrists. My dad, he says as soon as he puts his hands up for a little bit, they're essentially all feeling is gone. So it is a big deal. People really don't take care of themselves worth a crap, but, kids over the last year, I believe childhood obesity went up by about 25%, which if you ask me, that's like straight up abuse. There's no reason to let your kids, you know, eat like complete and total crap, because when you set them on a trajectory, then they may be obese for the rest of their life. And it's going to be very, very hard for them to get lean again. Your body has a certain amount of fat cells. And at a certain point, the fat in your fat cells spills over into, the surrounding area of your organs, that's your viscera. And that's when you start to run into a lot of like disease. And that's a huge, huge problem for people who, you know, don't get on the kind of fitness wagon. So, you know, there's a certain point where your body just won't accept any more fat. And then you just keep going down and down and down, you know, till you know, you get liver cancer or whatever. But yeah, it's a shame that we've like kids, you know, get obese over the last year and tell them, well, stay inside, wear a mask, and, you know, hopefully you don't die. And I mean, we did the same thing with adults, but like I said before, you would think over the last 2 years that they would have said something about, hey, you know, get outside, try to eat a little bit better. I actually had a friend who's a little bit scared of the vid argue with me. Well, we've been telling people to exercise for years. Okay, well, if you choose not to at this point, then you're accepting the risks that come with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's funny that, you know, so many people have faith that, or I shouldn't say they have faith, but they have this idea that we just need these government institutions to protect us from corporations that are nefarious and want to hurt us. But if you look at the FDA, I mean, they just got bought out by the sugar lobby throughout the years, and they were convincing people that animal fat was more unhealthy for you, or sorry, yeah, that animal fat was more unhealthy for you than sugar was. Right. So, you know, it's kind of like the EPA protecting oil companies. I mean, we just got to this point where every arm of the government is just bought out by whoever wants it. But that seems to play a big role in people getting fatter and people getting more and more unhealthy because they were telling us bullshit for decades about what you were supposed to eat.
Yeah, it's essentially the fox guard in the hen house. It's like reappointing Janet Yellen to head of the Treasury. Fed chair. The way that animal fat kind of got demonized was by something called, I believe it was the 7-country study. So Ansel Keys back in the 50s, I want to say, I might have some of these dates wrong, but he went to countries all across the world and tried to correlate what was causing heart attacks. Well, back in the early 20s, they had started using vegetable oil, which was originally used for lubricant machines, to replace butter, because they said, oh, butter and lard, that's your grandmother's stuff, move on to this stuff. Well, this machine lubricant doesn't really work well for us. And the other problem is that it's very calorically dense. So it's very, very easy to get a lot of it and not realize that you've eaten, you know, a couple hundred calories on top of what you're already eating. So they started demonizing saturated fat using the 7-country study because they said, oh, look, all these people who eat meat are dying of heart attacks. Well, the thing that they didn't explain is that these studies typically use what was called a food frequency questionnaire, where they ask people, okay, how many cups of ribs have you had over the last year? Which if you ask me, I could not tell you accurately at all how many cups of ribs, how much steak, how much whatever I ate over the last year. And they kind of ran with this hypothesis and it never really panned out. And I believe it's actually in the 80s that there was a study done by the group that actually showed the complete opposite, that people who have, who ate a lot of saturated fat had better mortality, like they lived a longer period of time. Now there's even a lot of data that comes out now that a higher cholesterol level might lead to a longer life overall. And people who have the highest meat, fruit, and vegetable intake actually die the least, like they have the longest life, versus people who just have a high meat intake. They tend to have more cancer and more issues. But the other problem is that people, because we've been told that meat is bad for you for so long, that typically people who don't care about their health eat meat, and then people who care about their health, you know, eat vegetables. But, you know, it's just the fact that meat typically comes in like a, you know, you think about your burgers, your fried foods. That's typically what people are eating. So it's not just the meat by itself. It's everything else you're getting with it. And typically it comes with stuff that makes it a lot easier to consume a lot of. So when you look at like a burger, you're looking at, you know, a bun, you're looking at the lettuce, the sauces, everything all together, and it tastes amazing. So, you know, it's easy to pound one down, and then without knowing, you just ate, you know, 3000 calories, let's say, you know, between all your greasy vegetable oil soaked fries and your hamburger. Where if you just ate the burger by itself, then you may get less calories and it's not going to be as bad for you, but you're just getting the fat and protein. And I don't have anything against carbohydrates, but when you mix carbohydrates and fats together to a large degree, it's just become so easy to overconsume.
Yeah. And then, like you said, a lot of people who care about their health are not eating meat, where mm-hmm. a lot of people who don't are. So that's going to, obviously, if in your life, you're trying to take care of yourself, you're exercising, you're eating a lot of other stuff that's good for you, and you're not eating meat. But if you're someone who's a slob who, you know, is eating corn dog over corn dog along with meat, that's just going to feed into the narrative that meat is bad for you, because you look at all these meat eaters who are really unhealthy, and then you see everyone who's trying to be healthy eating less meat. So it just adds on to the narrative, right?
Yeah, there's a concept called the healthy user bias, and that kind of can explain a lot of these, what they're called, epidemiology studies, where basically they're just looking for association. And anybody that knows anything knows that correlation isn't necessarily causation.
Right.
So a lot of people tend to just point to the red meat and say, oh, look, the saturated fat and cholesterol is going to kill you. But the other thing is that I actually did a carnivore diet for about 2 years, and this is just my anecdotal case, but my cholesterol was on the high end of normal, and literally – all I ate every day, I probably ate 2 pounds of red meat every single day, and my cholesterol didn't really go that high. And it was really, really funny to me that all my coworkers were saying that I was going to die of a heart attack, but meanwhile, they're shoveling down, you know, fully loaded pops and sugary junk, you know, Little Debbie's and all that. But then as soon as I come in with ground beef, now all of a sudden I'm going to die. But, you know, I lost 50 pounds. Digestive issues went away and I felt fantastic, but yeah. The red meat's going to kill me.
Yeah. There does seem to be like a more left wing obsession with taking care of yourself in a physical form, like taking care of your body, actually, than there is on the right. Why do you think that is?
Honestly, I couldn't really give a good explanation for that, but now that you mention it, that's definitely true. Typically, if you look at how people's personalities play out, Jordan Peterson, if you listen to anything by him, he goes into the big five personality traits, but, people who are left typically tend to be high in openness, which means that they're very interested in ideas and abstractions, and they're low in conscientiousness. So they're not, you know, big on discipline and hard work. And that's not to say that nobody who's politically left isn't hardworking, but it's just, right. You know, you think about your typical right winger, they're a little bit more dutiful, where they feel like it's their responsibility to go to work. It's their responsibility to show up on time and, you know, do your duty while you're working.
Right.
It's maybe because like vegans, if you ever notice, they kind of have like this intertwined thing, you know, people always joke about the almond milk latte with some hipster vegan, you know, doing their meditation. That's really the only explanation I think I can give. I know it's all kind of all over the place, but yeah, that's about the best way I could explain it. I never really thought about that though.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about it either. It just kind of came to me right there, but more of the left wing people I know are in better shape. Like most of the obese people I know are on the right, or, you know, so I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. I think there does tend to be this left wing culture that prides, you know, in like cultivation or preservation, and maybe they, you know, they apply that to their own health as well. Maybe that's, you know, where it comes from.
So this can kind of go down an interesting rabbit hole, because people believe that veganism is going to save the planet, which is technically, or actually pretty much factually, false. So when you do monocrop agriculture, sorry, can't talk. This actually causes the soil to lose all the nutrients, and you can actually, you know, start to deplete. The grass won't be able to grow on this soil anymore, or like, you know, there'll be a lot of runoff. So when it rains, instead of that soil taking in the water, it runs off. Now, what can actually happen if you raise cows in the correct way, as in you raise them in a regenerative fashion, where you have cows in a giant herd, and you know that you allow them to eat, piss and shit in where they're eating, and then move them to a different area, then that grass and the dirt actually becomes healthier, essentially, where it's able to sequester carbon back into the soil, right? So when you raise cows in this kind of fashion, you actually can start reversing climate change, or the damage that we've done to the environment, however great that may be, you know, great or bad, however you look at it. So what a lot of people don't know is that when you raise cows the way they're supposed to be raised, is that it's actually beneficial and good for the planet. Nobody talks about this, but there's all sorts of ranches all over the U.S. Rome Ranch, I think, is one. Bel Campo, White Oak Pastures. There's a few up here in Pennsylvania. I think the one is called Star Farms, which is only a couple minutes away from me. But when these cows basically live the way they're supposed to live, on grass, then it can sequester carbon back into the soil. But when you constantly make all these plants, you're tilling the soil for soybeans or wheat, it's actually bad for the soil. And that's not to say that we shouldn't make those products, but if you raise cows the way they're supposed to be raised, then you can start to reverse climate change. Someone had once said that if you got 40% of all U.S. Farms over from, you know, the conventional feedlot operations to grass-fed, grass-finished operations, then you could reverse all man-made climate change. Now, I don't know how much truth there is to that, but there's different videos by different farmers that you can look up where they show that the soil is able to, you know, sequester the carbon, or, you know, hold the water a lot better when the cows are raised properly. There's a book by Rob Wolf called Sacred Cow, and I haven't read it. I really want to. But what they found is actually one of those plant-based burgers does the same amount of damage as a grass-fed, grass-finished burger does to heal the environment. I know that I kind of butchered that, but basically your grass-fed burger versus your plant-based burger, the grass-fed burger is good for the environment. The plant-based one is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually, I don't know if it was the guy you just mentioned, but I watched a short documentary this guy had done, and he'd gone to several different countries, I think, and introduced what you're talking about. Like, there were just these completely dead areas, and he just brought animals to graze, and it brought plant life back in those fields. I mean, it was crazy. I can't remember what his name was, but one of my
Joel Salatin.
That sounds familiar. It might have been him. I honestly can't remember. But I watched it last year, and it was mind blowing. Like, I've heard of this stuff we talked about. It's really interesting. You know, this is kind of a good way to go with this. A lot of left wing people I know, I think they really care about a lot of this stuff. But most of the left wingers I know are in the cities, and they don't realize how things actually work. So, you know, they want to do something that makes themselves feel good, like they're contributing, like they're trying to do their part to save the planet or whatever. But they don't realize the work that actually goes into, you know, power generation, like where I used to work, or what goes into transportation, or what goes into agriculture, like we were just talking. They're really not that aware, where a lot of these people that you and I probably know, who actually work out in the field, they realize what actually does waste a lot of fuel, or what wastes a lot of resources, or a lot of money, or whatever. But they're never really listened to. You know, they don't really care what we say, They care what the engineers say and what the educated elites say. That's what actually drives policy. It's very rarely they actually talk to people who are doing stuff on the field.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's weird because you would think that if the left wingers really cared about the environment, then they would advocate for nuclear power, right? Because nuclear is a very, very dense source of energy, so you don't need a lot of it, and it doesn't create a lot of pollution. Right. They would advocate for grass-fed, grass-finished beef because not only do you get a better product, it's better for the environment, it's better for the cows because cows are raised better. But you never hear the left wing talking about this, which blows my mind. But it's because they have this, you know, the global warming agenda where cow farts and humans are bad. We're ruining the planet. You know, you can't have kids because you're going to, overpopulate the planet, which if you really look around, if there was any kind of situation where we were overpopulated, there's plenty of room out there where we could, you know, facilitate the people. I mean, and clearly we're not going to have any kind of starvation problem. If anything, people are eating way too much. There's no real population problem, despite what people want to say. Because, you know, the global poverty rate is way lower than it was even 50 years ago. So I just don't believe there's evidence to this argument that we're overpopulated or that we're destroying the planet. Because also, if you look, some forests all over the world are greener than they've ever been. So it's just this agenda to beat people over the head. You know, you're bad for driving cars and eating meat and wanting to have kids. Jordan Peterson said it once, but I've always said it to other people. You know, if you think humans are such a problem, then you can leave. You know, if you really think that we're the source of all problems, then you can just off yourself and go. And obviously I'm not telling anybody to kill themselves, but if you really think we're the problem, then you can contribute to your own solution. That's, you know.
Yeah. So did working in a trade push you toward libertarianism? Because it certainly did with me. I think, you know, I always say that the empirical influences on my life through working led me to realize that centralized planning, top-down structures don't really work, that if you kind of let everybody do their own thing, things are going to move much more smoothly. And I also realized like how horrible OSHA and all the regulations they put on workers were. And then I eventually just took that upstairs with, okay, well, if this is such a disaster, the military, the CIA, the FBI, the DHS, all of those must be a disaster too. That's kind of what initially kicked it off for me. Was there anything like that with you, or how did you get there?
Surprisingly, no. But how I kind of came to libertarianism was, I think it's kind of interesting. My brother was a big leftist initially. And I remember the one day he was saying, "Oh, I'm not a liberal, I'm a libertarian." And I said, "Oh, well, just get the hell away from me until you know what the hell you are." And I kind of kept that in the back of my mind, but I always felt like I leaned right, like I identified more with right-wing people. But after seeing him kind of go down that leftist, you know, thing, and he's a libertarian now, obviously, like him and I are on the same page, anarcho-capitalists. But after kind of seeing him go down that, I'm like, well, I'm definitely not that, so no. But, you know, I kept thinking about it, and I started listening to people like Stefan Molyneux, Dave Smith, Spike Cohen, Peter Schiff, you know, Rand Paul, Ron Paul.
Reed.
But all their ideas seemed to make sense. And up until like 2 years ago, I was pretty back the blue. I still considered myself a libertarian, but I was back the blue. And yeah, they hate us for our freedom. And then I started to learn more about war and, you know, kind of what actually war is and how it affects our country, how it affects individuals, you know, how it affects the budget. And I realized, well, that's really, really bad. And then after the George Floyd incident, and it's crazy to me how recent this was, but that I realized, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't be backing the blue because, you know, putting people, peaceful people, into cages for nonviolent crimes just doesn't make any sense at all. Like, you know,
yeah,
George Floyd was in terrible, terrible health, and I hate to say it, he probably would have died anyways, because I believe his arteries were like 90% clogged. But that, yeah, that absolutely gives nobody the right to put their knee on his neck for freaking 9 minutes. It was clearly negligent homicide. So, you know, lock the dude up, throw away the key. But, you know, it's completely wrong. So it took me a while, and it was a very, very progressive thing, but it was never like I just came to libertarianism. But the other thing that kind of pushed me more so towards libertarianism was actually this whole Trump deal. It really exposed the right, in my opinion. And I really haven't heard a lot of libertarians talk about this, but Trump really exposed a lot of right wingers, and actually a lot of libertarians too, for having no principles. Because when you look at Trump, and especially his rhetoric and what he says, his rhetoric was good on war, but though in effect, he was a neocon. I mean, he upped drone strikes by 450%, put more boots on the ground in Somalia. And then when you look at his rhetoric around guns, he was terrible on the Second Amendment. He banned bump stocks, which I like that video that you shared earlier. I retweeted it, but my point was essentially the bump stock ban was just a virtue signal to try and appease people that will never like him anyways.
You know, what's funny is I released that video in 2019. I put it out in like November.
Yeah.
But then it went viral for the first time. It went viral twice, but the first time it went viral was last year in like June or July. And I went through reading all the comments, and they're all like, this is why we need to vote for Trump, or the Democrats will take our guns away. And I was just like, oh my God. You know who banned those?
They don't get it. And this was the most frustrating part, is that I work with all boomer cons, and I've gone down this road with them more times than you could possibly imagine. And you know what they say? Oh, he had to appease the left. Appease the left? Are you kidding me? They hate him. Yeah. They hate you. They hate me. They will never like any of us. If you carry a gun, if you work a blue-collar job, dude, these leftists hate your guts. What are you doing? Just because somebody used a bump stock to kill some people, and I'm very sorry to the families, obviously. Dude, it's a straight-up virtue signal. And then he literally said, I believe prior to that, in an interview, Mike Pence had asked him, would you be for, with due process, you know, giving families more tools to potentially take away the to potentially take away firearms from people who they may think are dangerous? And he said, I like to take the guns early, due process second, something like that.
If I remember right, he sort of cut him off, actually. He was like, actually, Mike, you know what? Why don't we take them first and then go through due process second? Yeah. You could tell everyone around the table was like, you're off script. Stop talking.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny is that I've argued with so many fucking right wingers about this, and they said, oh, this is out of context. What context do you need? What other context is there around take the guns first, due process second?
Yeah, but Kyle, he only wants to take them from bad people.
Yeah. Well, once again, who are the bad people? Who defines the bad people? And how are you going to define if they're bad people or not?
Well, there never could have been, you know, a switch in power from Trump or the Republicans. The Republicans were always going to be in charge. So, you know, as long as they dislike the same people we do, everything's going to be fine. It's not like the power can suddenly switch hands and then like, oh, shit, all that power we just gave the government, they're going to now use it against us. You know, what a novel concept that would be.
So this comes to a really, really interesting point, and I don't have an answer, but it's a question that's been kind of digging at me a little bit. So Ron DeSantis and some of these, you know, right-leaning governors are banning vaccine mandates, which is okay. And I agree with it. It's obviously not perfectly libertarian. But the problem therein lies is what happens when they're not in power. You said it earlier, you know, okay, this is great, but it's like a Band-Aid on a snake bite. And, you know, it's good that OSHA's, you know, not enforcing this mandate now. It's suspended. But, you know, the problem with taking over the Republican Party, and, you know, we have Republicans top to bottom in government, and, you know, let's say even we get a Ron Paul, and we could do everything that we want to do. what is stopping you, or what is stopping the left or the people you don't want from taking that power in 4 years and reversing everything that's done? Because, you know, what happened with Joe Biden as soon as he got in? He was, you know, filing executive order after executive order to undo all the stuff that Trump did. So, you know, is it really meaningful change to just say, hey, this is illegal and our guy's in charge, so, you know, we're never going to lose his power? Well, it's not a long-term solution. I get it in the short term, it works, but I don't know what the long-term solution is other than trying to roll back the state. But, you know, that's, once again, that's not a short-term thing either.
Yeah, I think it's nullification from state governments, you know, like that is, in my mind, the only defensive move you can make. Because if you do anything else, like if you try to weaponize the state against people that are doing things you don't like, I just think that always comes back to bite you. I mean, you know, in my lifetime, the right wingers started out by doing that. In the early 2000s, it was like, fuck the gays, fuck the Muslims, fuck whatever, you know, like, fuck them. And so now the tides have turned and revenge is being taken out on the right wingers now. And I do think it's going to swing back the other way. Like, I think the left has been so retarded and so overbearing and so obnoxious that the culture is going to swing right again. And then there is going to be this massive push for government control over the left. And I think the only way you can defeat that is be like, nope, fuck you. We're not going to do what you want us to do. Because then, you know, say in Pennsylvania or Utah, if New Yorkers really want this horrible policy, they're just a bunch of people with bad opinions in New York.
Right. Like,
okay. You know, I think that's really the only way to protect yourself and defend yourself against future attacks is by like just saying, nope, you have no power here. You know, you can be like Gandalf on the bridge, you know, you shall not pass. Like,
yeah,
that's what you got to do, I think.
Yeah. You essentially got to throw the ring into the fire because, you know, nobody should have that. I do think that there is a huge opportunity for libertarians in 2022 and 2024. But we got to be on it. We have to be ready to speak up about the issues, and we
like
can't
trans rights and sex work. Yeah. And,
yeah. Well, you know, there's a trans genocide going on.
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, with Joe Biden in charge now, and especially these vaccine mandates and people recognizing inflation, we have to be on top of it. It is frustrating, though, because you know just as well as I do that if you ask a right winger if all this would be happening under Trump, they would say, no, no, he'd have it under control. When it's completely obvious that dude caved in 2020. I think you said it on my show. It might have been when we were talking afterwards. But it wasn't necessarily that Joe Biden won the election. It was that Trump lost. He fell apart in 2020. He said the year prior, America will never be a socialist nation. And then what happened? He said, eviction moratorium, stimulus checks, you know, throwing good money over bad to people who don't want to work, the generous unemployment benefits. And so many right wingers will share the pictures that say, oh, we're paying back all this stimulus now. And look at all this inflation under Joe Biden. And they'll, you know, put up the little stickers beside the gas thing and have Joe Biden pointing at it saying, I did this, which, okay, you're not wrong, but to, you know, say that Trump had no part in this is completely ridiculous and I would say factually incorrect, because when Trump was in charge, they had a Republican Congress and a Republican House, right? And he as a candidate was spot on. The economy's, you know, a bubble based on low interest rates. The stock market's a bubble based on low interest rates. If you put them up, then everything's going to pop. Everything's going to come tumbling down. He was right. But then what happens as soon as he gets in? Oh, we need negative interest rates. So he had the chance to do something great and he completely failed. And the onus is on the right to call him out for it, and they completely failed. So I know a lot of libertarians want to say that the right's our ally, and I agree to a point. But the problem is if a right winger gets in and they do the same old, they will never hold their feet to the fire, and they're not going to be good on anything. Because let's face it, when Trump was in, they didn't care about it. They didn't care about the spending. They didn't care about the bump stock ban. They didn't care about the fact that he wasn't anti-war as a president at all. they're not good on anything when it's their guy in charge because, oh, well, you know, that's the president and we got to respect the president.
Yeah. Yeah. Democrats suck all the time. Yeah. Republicans suck when they're in charge. Like when they're not in charge, they sound great. And they're like, oh, this is crazy. This is unconstitutional. It's overreach. But then as soon as they get in there, they're fucking awful. Yeah. And it wasn't just Trump. Like, you know, these stimulus bills, Republicans voted for
overwhelmingly for it.
Overwhelmingly. Yeah. Like, I mean, it was embarrassing. Dan Crenshaw voted against this latest infrastructure bill. And I think the infrastructure bill is $1.2 trillion. And don't get me wrong, it's not a good bill.
Yeah.
But if you look at that bill and you compare it to the ones that passed last year, it's less than half the size. And at least everything's being spent in this country, you know, not in Sudan, Israel, wherever else. Everything was, you know, there are billions and billions of dollars going overseas. So it's just hilarious to see him post this video about, like, you know, this is irresponsible. It's just like, dude, go fuck yourself.
Look at me. I'm a financial conservative. I'm fucking John McCain Jr. And I'm a financial conservative again now that the Democrats in charge. Dude, it's such a joke. Rand Paul, when he does the Festivus report, I absolutely love reading those. But they got $10.2 million in COVID test tubes, right? You know what they were? Empty pop bottles. $10.2 million. And I remember at the end of the year last year when they were talking about doing the second stimulus check, and everyone's like, oh, you know, Trump's fighting it. You know, they don't want all this pork in it. And then you look at Trump's revisions for it. It's like, essentially, instead of sending $2 million over to gender studies, and this isn't exactly it, but it kind of captures the point. Instead of sending $2 million over there, we'll just send $1.8 million. Like, dude, you don't have to sign this, but what do? Every single time, there you go. Write the blank check to whoever for whatever. And nobody ever criticized Trump for that, or at least no right-wingers, no prominent right-wingers. And now all of a sudden they feign like they care about the debt. No, sorry, your time has passed. You had a chance. You guys had your chance the first 2 years, and you completely blew it. So go fuck yourself.
What was funny is while the election was going on, Trump put out these ads that were showing the rioting in Kenosha and, you know, Minneapolis and all over the place, everything burning and on fire. And it said, this is Biden's America. And it was like, dude, you are the president right now, you know, like, and all these Republicans nowadays, they're talking about how, you know, we suddenly had authoritarianism under Biden and chaos. Like, where were you last year? I mean, Trump was president all of 2020.
And he criticized Georgia for not locking down. He criticized Georgia for not locking down. He criticized Sweden for not locking down. Like, you think this dude wouldn't be pumping the vaccines or voting for, or, you know, pushing the vaccine mandate?
Every Republican governor, except for Kristi Noem, did some sort of shutdown in their state. I don't know. Maybe not Alaska. I don't know about, but I think like pretty much every state. And then Ron DeSantis did change course after a little while, to his credit. He was against it. But, and then Abbott eventually, but, you know, like, that's, it was not a good showing by Republican governors or Republicans in Congress or Republicans in state houses. Like, it was just a massive failure on every level by every institution and every party, including the Libertarian Party. They didn't do that great either. You know, it was just like, it was just a year where nobody was standing up. It was just, I don't know. It was really aggravating.
Yeah, and it's very, very surprising to see other countries where we would have laughed at them 2 years ago and said, ah, you know, you guys got tyranny over there. We wouldn't put up with that. Well, I guess we fucked around and found out. Now, you know, tyranny's here and nobody gives a shit. And it's really, really surprising because I think everybody thought that that the American people wouldn't tolerate everything that they tolerated. But I guess we're a lot more docile of a population than maybe we all thought we were.
Yeah. Well, I think they were clever about how they went about it. And what they do is they scare you into submission. They never like force you into submission. 'Cause that's stupid. No one's ever going to do that. Like if you just sicked the cops on everybody, sent the National Guard into every city, and were like forcing people into their houses, then you'd actually see people be like, no, fuck you. But if you can terrify them into, you know, self quarantining and self shutting down, and then on top of that, you can give them perks through government subsidies, you know, like, hey, we're going to give you a PPP loan, or we're going to give you unemployment, or we're going to give you stimulus checks. That's the intelligent way to do it. And that's how they did do it. And that's why everyone fell for it. I mean, if it had just, so it's authoritarianism blanketed in humanitarianism, you know, that's the only effective way to do it. And they actually pulled it off, but then they fucked up with like the vaccine mandate. That is not under the guise of humanity. I mean, they tried, but it just didn't work. It was like, I mean, because the statistics didn't line up. There was no prize for doing it. And everyone was like, and then they're saying, like, we're going to have vaccine passports. And, you know, you're not going to be able to fly. You're not going to be able to go to a grocery. And then everyone was like, no, fuck you. And then that hasn't worked so far. You know, OSHA is saying they're not going to enforce it. We've had, I don't even know what the number is now, but the last number I knew was 29 states were like, nope, fuck you. We're not doing this. So, you know, that's when they overplayed their hand and they fucked up.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's funny because even a lot of my boomer coworkers who are the most pro-Trump people you could possibly imagine, a lot of them are around trying to tell people to get the jab. And, you know, they're, I don't want to say they're on, you know, straight up simping for the COVID regime, but they're damn near helpless to it. But that being said, I guess a little bit more of an optimistic note is that I really don't think there is a appetite for this vaccine mandate. I read a article on one of the videos I did where they surveyed 800 people and they said, oh, Americans are split 50-50 on vaccine mandates. I'm like, 800 people? That's your survey? And you're going to say that's representative of 330 million people? No, that's not how it works at all. But like I said, I really do think a lot of people, even vaccinated people, are starting to see through the charade. And I really don't think they want this vaccine mandate because it's ridiculous. You know, people say, it's like you've been vaccinated for other things. Yeah, but this is different. You know, you can prevent yourself from getting COVID. And even if you get COVID, a vast majority of people are fine. It's treatable. And you know, if you catch it early enough, get monoclonal antibodies or whatever treatments, you'll be okay. Yeah. So, you know, this is completely different than getting vaccinated from polio. So I don't think people want to have to show a card just to enter a restaurant. And, you know, to the people who are thinking a vaccine mandate is a good idea, you know, just think about the consequences of this and think about what it looks like. You know, this looks like, potentially, in worst case scenario, police going to businesses and arresting people because they choose not to pay a fine for a vaccine mandate. This looks like people losing their jobs because of a medical condition that they can't get the vaccine. There are legitimate concerns to this, and I think people should think long and hard before they advocate for this. You know, we're looking at this labor shortage now, and it's funny, 2 years ago, the economy was booming, right? Quote unquote, right. Because everybody, you know, everybody was hiring, but now all of a sudden nobody wants to work. It's funny how that light switch kind of flips on and off. But, you know, if you want things to get dramatically worse, then push for this vaccine mandate. And I think things will get dramatically worse. And I just don't think there's an appetite for it. But, you know, I it's the wrong way to go. You and I both know it's the wrong way to go.
Yeah. Well, let's change gears here a little bit. Sure. So you're a mechanic. Why did you decide to go into a trade? Was that right out of high school or did you go to college first, or how did that end up happening?
So my family has been in the automotive business for, I would be the fourth generation. So pretty much ever since we jumped off the boat from Czechoslovakia or Poland, with whichever one of those two we came from, I'm not exactly sure. We've been holding wrenches.
Czechoslovakia to avoid the Polish jokes, you know, just a.
So, my great grandfather owned a shop. My grandfather owned a shop. My dad owns a shop now. Maybe I will. I don't know. But I've been working on cars for pretty much 10 years now. I started working for my dad back in about 2012 between summers when I went to high school, and then my last year in high school, I worked for a dealership. And I went to Votech school when I was in high school, and then after high school, I went to a automotive college in Cleveland, Ohio, which Cleveland's a pretty big shithole, in case anybody was wondering. But I graduated actually on top of my class. I was the only one to graduate as a master certified mechanic. I had perfect attendance minus a half a day because I had a speeding ticket to go go to court for. And I was the most recognized student out of every single student in that entire class. So it's a little bit of a point of pride for me. But ever since then, it's been downhill. Working on cars kind of sucks, but it is an honest living. And like I said, I'm the fourth generation mechanic. I probably have probably almost $70,000 in tools. My dad, no shit, probably has at least $1 million in tools in his little two-bay shop. But you know, I've done it for 10 years, and I think I've made a good living for myself. I'm 27 now, and I've owned my house now for about 5 years. It's not paid off, but you know, to be a homeowner in your early 20s is pretty cool, in my opinion. And yeah, that's kind of what led me all the way down there. I recently left. I guess I've been with General Motors. That's kind of another thing. But yeah, I've been with General Motors for pretty much the entire time as well. Mainly work on just Buick, GMC, and Cadillac. A little bit of Chevrolet, but I haven't worked for a Chevy dealer in about 6 years.
So you don't wish you had gotten like a liberal arts degree or something so you could be a successful person, or?
No, you know what? I feel like I've done better than a lot of those people. And a lot of the people that I know that went to college for other stuff, I'm doing way better than them.
Yeah, same here.
It sounds arrogant, but at the same time, you know, you guys spent like six figures in debt to go to college. And then what do you have to show for it? A lot of these people live in their mom's basement, or, you know, they're going living in these apartment complexes with a whole shitload of other people, paying ass loads of money for rent, driving on a, you know, driving a car with bald tires. And, you know, I've kept my life a little bit more simple. I drive a car with a manual transmission, roll up windows. I got a 1984 Monte Carlo. That's my project car. My fiance has a 2016 Terrain and a 2006 Cobalt with roll up windows. Our Terrain's like the nicest vehicle that we own, but, yeah, we keep it low key. I didn't go for the nicest house that money could buy. I went within my means. If I would have waited a little bit longer, I probably could have got a nicer house. But in hindsight, I'm glad that I got this specific house because I can manage the payments. And if, you know, things go downhill at work, then I can afford to make the payments no matter what. And I guess one thing that's interesting about being a mechanic is that you have to be productive because you're paid flat rate, right? So it's not like you just go in, you punch in, you get paid. You have to be working. You have to be turning in jobs successfully, as in completing the vehicle, you know, doing whatever repairs were quoted at the time they're quoted to get paid. So basically, like, if a job quotes 3 hours, it pays 3 hours. And if you get it done in 2 hours, you get paid that 3 hours. If you get it done in 4 hours, you'll get paid that 3 hours. So pretty much by nature, it's very capitalist in a sense, because you have to be working, you have to be productive. And, you know, I still see people, flat rate techs that, you know, go outside, they'll turn a bolt, go smoke a cigarette, turn a bolt, go smoke another cigarette. And then they wonder why they don't make any time. Well, I don't smoke or anything like that, but, you know, I stay on top of things and I try to be as productive as possible while I'm working. So that's kind of the background as to why I work on cars.
Yeah, no, I hear you, man. I mean, when you're talking about your friends that were in high school with your college, that went to college, I've noticed the same thing. I mean, I made $100,000 when I was 24, I think. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think anyone else in my class made that by the time they were 24. And I had no idea what I wanted to do in high school. You know, I actually was going to become a cop, believe it or not. And I was thinking about joining the military too. And those would have been interesting in hindsight. But I don't know. I would not take back the blue collar life. I mean, to me, it gives me so much more energy to think about politics or philosophy. Whereas if I were doing an office job, I feel like my brain would just be fried. Like, I have to think doing my job, and you have to think too, but it's not the same type of thinking. You know, when you're thinking and working, it's like a more hands-on kind of applicable type of thought, instead of a more, you know, abstract thought that if you have an office job, it seems like it would just exhaust all of that. Cause my dad's a teacher. And I can't imagine being a teacher and then trying to do a podcast or care about politics or anything outside of teaching. Yeah. I mean, I would rather my dad, whenever he has time off, he goes and splits wood or mows the lawn or, you know, does something at work. Cause he's so used to just, you know, doing intellectual stuff. Yeah. All the time. But do you know Matthew Crawford? Have you ever heard of him?
Name rings a bell.
Yeah. So I haven't read any of his books yet. I need to, but I've watched several of his interviews, and he wrote one book called Why We Drive. And then I think another one was the Case for Manual Labor. And he's just basically talking about how, as we become disconnected from all these things, you know, we become like less human almost, like we kind of lose the appreciation for life. When you were talking about, you know, your cars you have, like my Toyota pickup that bit the dust this last summer, I bought that in 2015. It's a 1994 manual transmission, roll up windows, had 194,000 miles on when I bought it. I got it up to 330,000 miles. I replaced I replaced the engine in it myself. I did all the, you know, all the suspension, all the brakes, did it all myself. Like I basically replaced everything except the transmission, for functionality myself, you know, just with help from other people. And that gave me such a connection with the machine that, you know, like unlike I've ever had with anything else. I was just like, I know this thing inside and out. And you know, I've touched everything in here and I've replaced everything in here. This truck is like an extension of me. When I got in that crash, that really, it sucked more on like a almost a spiritual level, because I was just so connected to that thing. So now what I have, I bought a 1991 4Runner with the same engine. So, you know, I still know how to fix everything because it's basically the same thing. But do you think do you notice that too? Like the less connected we become with our work or with our machines or with the outdoors or whatever, like we just become less interesting and less appreciative of things and less human in general.
Yeah. You know what? Actually, I would agree. And I never thought about that, but yeah, it totally does make sense, because manual labor is incredibly satisfying. So for me personally, although I wish I could get out of working on cars, I don't think I ever will. There is something insanely satisfying for me personally. It's brutal, brutal work. But like when I find that broken wire that's causing this specific issue, I just, it's so satisfying, and it gives me, you know, a sense of like purpose. You know, I feel like this is it. This is why I do what I do. I had a 2021 Cadillac XT5 with a motor that was blown up, and it took me forever. And, you know, obviously because there's not that many people that work on cars and there was just a cascade of people being off, it took me a little bit to, you know, get to it and get it done. But the ability for me to literally take a brand new vehicle that nobody's ever done this on, nobody that I know, and literally drop the whole engine and transmission on the ground, move the engine, put a new one in it, put it back up in the car, run it, drive it overnight, bring it back to the to my work, and know that I did the job right. There's something very, very, very satisfying about it. And I get a little freaked out when it comes to doing these big projects, and I seemingly do a lot more of them now. When you're done with it, like I said, it's just very, very satisfying. I had a brand new Yukon once where the rear tail light would turn on for like a second and then turn back off, and then it would do that like every 10 seconds. Well, when they put it together at the factory and they put the rear applique on, there's two lights right beside it. They pinched a wire that was going to the one light, and that was causing that light to flicker on and off like that. But once I fixed it, it was good. But yeah, to kind of sum up that long tangent there, I do think there's a lot of value in manual labor, and that a lot of people get their self-esteem and how they overall feel about themselves from their work. And I feel like these office jobs and jobs where you're not necessarily working with your body in your hands, I don't think there's that same sense of gratification, at least in my opinion. And I don't think I would find the same satisfaction doing, you know, a job like that. And I mean, there's satisfaction when I teach somebody something about cars or something about music, something about fitness. But there is just, like I said, a huge satisfaction to being able to do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to do a live stream where I'm jamming on the keyboard and you're playing the guitar or something.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, no. I played guitar now for probably about 15, 16 years, but that's another thing that, brings me a lot of joy. As you can see, all the guitars and amplifiers in the background, Metallica poster. And if you look all around my room, I got all sorts of music stuff, but that's a whole other rabbit hole and passion of mine.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's cool to see another young, successful libertarian who actually has a skill and then has hobbies that are interesting, like playing music. You know, you're right that libertarians are just not impressive when you think of them. You think of people who failed at life and then need something to feel good about themselves, you know. And
right.
They want to change.
Yeah, well, and I'm the same exact way. That's why I said earlier in the show, I want libertarians to feel like they can be jacked and they can have hobbies, because, you know, if your sole purpose in life is just libertarianism and that's all you do and all you do is go re about the state, then, I mean, okay, that's fine. We could do that. But what happens if you don't have that? Then what? You know, you're literally left with nothing. So what I kind of wanted to bring to the table with my show and who I am is that, look, I'm a musician. If I can't play music, then I'm going to podcast about libertarianism. If I can't podcast about libertarianism, then I'm going to talk about health. I'm an athlete as well. So, you know, I love working out. That's, you know, one of the things that's like a non-negotiable for me. I come home and I got to work out, or I go straight to the gym right after work. Every morning I take my dogs for a walk. Like, these are non-negotiable things. They're part of my daily ritual. Every single morning I'm up at about 4 to 6 o'clock every single morning. Even if my band plays a show and we're playing till 11 or midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm still usually up about 6 o'clock in the morning. So that way I can get up, you know, cook my food, walk my dogs. It's just non-negotiable for me. So I want more libertarians to be of the mindset that you should be kind of not stretched thin, but you should have, you know, interest in all these different areas, because that's how we're going to develop a more broad libertarian culture. Because, you know, we could be all in on politics, but, you know, then people really don't care as much when, you know, there's something else that needs to come up. And like I said, we could read about the state all day, every day. But if you don't have anything else to offer, then how are you ever going to bring other people in?
Yeah, for sure. Well, where can people keep up with you, man? I've got your Twitter and your YouTube linked in the description, but is there anywhere else? Want people to see what you're doing, or do you have any interesting shows coming up you want to plug? Or,
you know, I wish. actually, if anybody's around in Pennsylvania, my band A Common Crown is opening for Stephen Piercy of Rat. That's going to be at Jurgles on December 1st. Tickets are still available, and that's probably going to be this show's probably going to sell out. So I'm pretty stoked to do that. That's probably one of our bigger shows. We opened for Steel Panther last year, which is really cool too. But that show's coming up. If you follow my band on Facebook and look us up at acommoncrown.com, all one word, you'll see all our shows and stuff there. Check out my podcast, In Liberty and Health. If you look up my name, Kyle Matovic, my last name is spelled a little weird, Matovcik. You'll be able to find me pretty much anywhere podcasts are available. Find me on Facebook, add me, check all my stuff out. I mostly talk about libertarian stuff and health. Would like to get some more people on as well, you know, who are of all persuasions, really. So, yeah, that's pretty much my stuff there, man.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on. That was a good convo. We'll get you back on again sometime.
Awesome. Love to do it.